Hello and welcome to Out in the Bay, gay radio from San Francisco. It's our 10th anniversary party broadcast. I'm Eric Jansen.
And I'm Marilyn Pittman. Welcome our guests here at the Oasis Cabaret and Nightclub in San Francisco's south of Market District at 11th and Folsom. Thanks to Heclina and Darcy Drollinger for letting us have the party here. It's an amazing space. Thank you very much.
We'd also like to thank our... Yes, thank you very much. We also want to thank our food sponsors, La Mediterranee and Bacon Bacon. Yum, yum.
You know, we've always thought of this radio program, which, of course, you can podcast and listen on demand to at outinthebay.org, as somewhat of an oral history project. Artists, authors, activists, celebrities, and everyday people with stories to tell.
One of the things that surprised us as we put this show together was how much has changed for LGBT people in America. When we started, we still had DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act. Now we don't. Now 37, I think that's right, states allow same-sex marriage, including California, and now trans people are taking on more and more focus for equal rights. So much has changed.
So we want to share highlights from 10 years of interviews. Let's get started with the very first piece we aired, the very first one. With Eric and David LaTulipe from KALW, they started this program.
So I went out on Castro Street to record the Castro walking tours that were led by the late Trevor Haley.
She was such a character, wasn't she?
She really was. She was so folksy, so down home. You know, I wondered, as she talked to me and she led me around the streets of the Castro, I wondered how much of this she was actually just making up. But she really knew her stuff. Trevor's been leading people on the Cruising the Castro walking tour since 1989. I caught up with her on a recent tour at the site where Harvey Milk's camera store stood. She was explaining how former supervisor Dan White had taken former supervisor Milk's life and the life of Mayor George Moscone in City Hall.
Both of these men, he shot him in the chest. Now, this was 1978, November of 78. He shot him in the chest, and when they fell, he pumped bullets into their heads. The last one for Harvey was inches from his head. There were no open caskets for those guys. They were blown to smithereens.
I think it's a very profound place to end the tour, because I really do think in many ways Harvey Milk is our Martin Luther King, and that he was an individual that could take an oppressed group of people, get that bunch organized, and have them believing in themselves, and that they could have their fair slice of the pie. And he knew in order to really achieve that, we had to get into office for ourselves. But he also knew that if he was successful with this endeavor, he had put his life on the line.
What are the things that people on your tours comment on or seem the most surprised about?
Well, I think one thing is how contemporary our history is and what a short period of time ago that we were illegal and arrested, and that at one time we were wards of mental health. And I think all of those things people are genuinely surprised at.
Trevor did the walking tour until 2005 when she sold the business, retired, and moved back home to Mississippi. She passed away not long after that.
Harvey Milk was the subject a few years later in 2008 of the Gus Van Sant film Milk, which went on to be nominated for 8 Oscars and win 2. Marilyn mixed audio of the actor speaking at a news conference with interviews of the director and 3 of the real-life people portrayed in the film. One of them was Harvey's campaign manager and aide, Ann Cronenberg, played by actor Allison Pill. Anne is now the executive director of the San Francisco Department of Emergency Management, and she's also a co-founder of the Harvey Milk Foundation.
When you first got hired by Harvey Milk, he told you not to take his yelling personally. How did you adapt to that?
I yelled back. As you can probably tell, I'm a pretty quiet person. It's not my nature. I grew up in a family that there was no yelling. So I had to learn. And Harvey said, you can't take anything personally. I'll yell. What you have to do is just scream back at me. And so that's what I learned to do. And then he'd just stop. So it was perfect. We'd have these screaming matches over stupid stuff. And then it blew over for him. It was over. I think that he gave me a lot of new tools for coping in a world of men, of coping in a professional world, in a business world that I might not have had if I hadn't known him. So, yeah, he taught me a lot of different things.
How do you see, and our history, since you've been there for these 30-some years, how do you see it evolving? I mean, we're fighting right now.
Yes, we are, but look at where we've come. when you look back 30 years ago, I mean, just seeing the film again, it made me think about No on Six, which, of course, we all know the Briggs Initiative, and we were able to defeat it. But it brought me right back in the moment how scary that was. And we really have come such a long way. I mean, the fight right now is for equality in marriage. Who would have thought that 30 years ago? I mean, it's just, and Harvey laid the groundwork. It was his courage, his advocacy, his willingness to just, you know, be out there, to be bold. I think he changed the course of history.
You're listening to a special broadcast of Out in the Bay, gay radio from San Francisco. We had our 10th anniversary party at the Oasis Cabaret and Nightclub in San Francisco with our friends and supporters.
Wow, that's not canned at all. We didn't prompt that, did we?
Isn't there a big applause sign over our heads? No? Like the Tonight Show? Our food comes from Jim Angelo's Bacon Bacon Food Truck and Cafe, their famous LGBT sandwich. Yeah, yeah, man. Thank you, Jimmy. And Ellenson Ico's La Mediterranee Noe at Noe and Market in the city, serving Mediterranean food to the Castro District for more than 30 years, all through the AIDS crisis.
You know, it's interesting to listen. I haven't heard some of these clips myself in quite a long time. It's a great trip down memory lane. So in 2005, I talked with author Keith Boykin about his book, Beyond the Down Low, Sex, Lies, and Denial in Black America. What is it you think that's keeping people from being more honest about what's going on?
Well, you know, a lot of us are lying. We, in the black community, for example, we have a don't ask, don't tell policy about sexuality. And if you look, for example, at the black church is the most homophobic institution in the black community. But at the same time, it's also the most homo-tolerant. The homophobia comes from the minister, from the pulpit. But the homo-tolerance comes if you look behind the minister, the choir members and the musicians, and the organists and the deacons and the ushers. They're gay and bisexual men all throughout the church. And nobody ever says you have to get up and go. They still take their tithes and offerings and accept that.
So and everybody knows, you're saying.
And everybody knows. We don't talk about it. Like I said, it's a don't ask, don't tell policy, but we know. And I think the biggest lie in terms of the down low is that we really want these men not to be on the down low. You know, a lot of people come up to me and they say, well, how can we stop these people from being on the down low? Why won't they just come out and be open and honest about who they are? And I don't think we realize how we are complicit in our own oppression. We don't want them to be out and open, because if they were, then we'd have to create a culture that deals with the homophobia in our community. And there are too many churches that preach homophobia, too many families that will kick people out because they're gay, too many friends who will disown their friends because they're gay. In that environment, why would someone come out and be open about who they are? If we really want to stop the down low, we have to stop the homophobia.
We've had a lot of fun doing this show, just by the way.
And, you know, I think perhaps our most famous was the film director, John Waters.
Look, you're on Out in the Bay, John Waters. Let's talk about the gay thing. Let's talk about gay marriage. What do you think about that whole fight?
Well, I've talked about it a lot. You know, I think, to be honest, that we should wait until a Democrat wins the election, and then they'll just say, okay, fine, gay marriage is legal. I thought the privilege of being gay is we did not have to be married or go in the army or have children or do all the things that everybody wants to do now. Total assimilation in the gay world. I don't fit in there either, because they have more rules than my parents.
Are you single?
I am single and alone and very happy about it. Alone and not lonely. I've had boyfriends, and I certainly have people that I see, but I could never live with anybody. I don't want to live with somebody. Anybody that could live in my house, I wouldn't want them to live with me if they said okay, because it's so me. You know, Tennessee Williams said the best, that my type wouldn't know who I am. I'm kind of like that. When you meet a few people and they don't know your movies, it's like saying, I love you.
You said a minute ago, so someone saw your house, you wouldn't want them to live with you.
I'm saying that my house is, you know, I collect contemporary art, so it's certainly my taste is everywhere. And certainly there's not an inch of room because of books in every room. And I wouldn't want, if they said, I think I'll hang up something here, I wouldn't like, probably, if I didn't like what they were hanging up. I like to read my papers in the morning by myself. I hate reading a paper that someone else has touched. I don't want used news, or nothing worse than you're reading the paper and they're reading one before you and say, listen to this one. I would like to discover the news on my own. Thank you.
He was great. He signed my underwear, too.
Another famous director this is one of my favorites of this whole 10 years. It's just been one of my favorite. It's amazing that Eric got this interview with Ang Lee. Ang Lee, the director.
So I had seen Brokeback Mountain at a media screening, so it was before it was released. I didn't know what it was about before. I didn't know what I was walking into before I went in. You know, as you know, it's about these two young sheep wranglers up in Montana who fall in love, and they just have this torturous affair for 20 years. And there was not a dry eye in the house among all these hard-boiled media critics in the audience of this film. That's how it came up, and that's how I happened to interview him at one of these tours he was on before the movie actually opened.
There aren't many sex scenes in this movie. The one that is most memorable is early on in the first summer when they first meet. And it's pretty violent, actually.
Well, I think violence and sex is pretty close nerves and fear. And it can be quite confusing. It's a very macho love story. I think that scene needs to be violent and spontaneous and intuitive. And immediately they know what to do, and then they should be confused, especially for Anna's part Heath Ledger played. He has no understanding. It was twisted feeling, but very strong, strong impulses.
And in a way, it seems like he doesn't really quite notice how much he loves Jack until he's gone.
Exactly, until it's too late.
The Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation has been quoted as saying this is a movie that can be really important for gay liberation and really open some hearts and minds. Do you see it that way?
I think it can be liberation for more than gay and lesbians. I think it can be very liberating for straight men as well. Mm-hmm. Because, as you said, open heart and mind, then you have less fear and resistance to something that is natural. That is complicated. The complexity is part of nature. Then if you're sensitive, you want to be honest and to search into the truth and touch it and deal with it. I think that honesty goes a long way. Personally, I believe so, and that's liberating.
So, you know, a few years later...
I just want to say that Eric has this way that of being so emotional and intimate with some of the interviews he does that he's able to draw that out for the audience, for you to enjoy that level of intimacy. And I think that's a credit to the way you approach the work.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. So when Josh Gamson's biography came out in 2005, The Fabulous Sylvester, about the late, great disco diva Sylvester, Marilyn created a sound portrait using her interview with Josh at the book launch party at the LGBT Center, and Josh reading from his book and some of Sylvester's music.
So during the Watts riots, I understand Sylvester was out looting. What was she looting? He looting?
Well, he was a member of a sort of sorority gang called the Discotes, and their main goal was to be fabulous and to party and to dress. And during the Watts riots, Sylvester said when everybody else was looting for TVs and stuff, they were stealing makeup and wigs and lipstick. He said just the fun stuff. And that was his life back then.
He was from South Central.
He was from South Central. I mean, they were partying in Watts.
Sylvester popped into stardom with suddenness and force, like an ember that is smoked for a while and then without warning ignited. For a few minutes, his life became one of those Stars Born, Oh My God, That's My Song movie montages, cut to Sylvester signing autographs on the streets of San Francisco, a large ring flickering and bracelets shivering, cut to sweaty men dancing, eyes closed, fists up and shirtless, cut to the Billboard charts, dates flapping by as the song shoots up the charts. Cut to ABC Sunday Night Football going to commercial as fans dance to Mighty Reel.
You're listening to a special broadcast of Out in the Bay, gay radio from San Francisco. We're at our 10th anniversary party at the Oasis Cabaret and Nightclub in San Francisco with our friends and supporters. Thank you so much. Our food comes from Jim Angelus's Bacon Bacon Food Truck and Cafe, their famous LGBT sandwich, and Ellen Sinaiko's La Mediterranee Noe at Noe and Market in the city, serving Mediterranean food to the Castro District for more than 30 years. We also thank our generous... Yes, thank you. We also thank our generous event underwriters, Brad Payton and Richard Merck, and Schiff Hardin, a general practice law firm serving clients in the U.S. and worldwide from 8 offices, including one here in San Francisco. And I just want to say, yeah, thank you. You know, some of the clips that we've been playing, you can hear the full broadcast on our Playing Favorites page on our website, outinthebay.org. So go check them out.
One of the most, I think, difficult interviews that Eric did, and one I would find daunting. And he courageously went into this interview with Judy Shepherd, Matthew Shepherd's mother, when her book came out, The Meaning of Matthew, My Son's Murder in Laramie and a World Transformed.
You know, you can beat yourself up forever with the what-ifs. We've tried really hard to move away from that. We all felt, Logan and Dennis and I, that we were in a really good place with Matt when we lost him. None of us had parted with him on bad words. There was no anger. There was a really good, close feeling among the family when we did lose him. He and I had had angry words a few days before, but we had spoken since and took care of all of that. I let him know how much I loved him, and he returned how much he loved me. So we all felt like we were in a good place with him. If we had not been in Saudi Arabia, if he had not been in Laramie, if could just drive a person insane. We just can't deal with that. It isn't what happened. So we just try to move on.
Okay. Do you believe anything in McKinney's defense team story that his own sexual abuse as a child contributed in any way to this rage that he took out on Matt?
You know, it doesn't matter if I believe it or not. It doesn't excuse anything he did that night. They both, those young men, had horrible childhoods, horrible family life. Doesn't excuse what they did that night. It's not a mitigating factor. They made many, many conscious decisions that night to continue their assault on Matt and leave him there and continue to leave him there. They've not, either one of them, shown any kind of remorse for what they did to Matt. They feel remorseful for where they are, but not for what they did to Matt. Do we need to forgive them? It's really not on my radar. I blame society equally, if not more, for creating the environment that made them think it was okay to do that to Matt. That's our goal now, is to change that.
And Judy Shepherd went on from that to start the Matthew Shepherd Foundation and this whole effort she made to pass hate crimes legislation, get them passed throughout the country, federal law, hate crimes law.
Which we now have.
Yes, which we now have. So she's been so courageous. And the other thing, one of the things that was difficult about this interview, I'd read her book, and she was clearly, she says in the book, she's very distrustful and fearful of the media. She doesn't like the media. And so I knew going in it was difficult because, you know, here's this mother who's lost her son in this horrible way, even if it was 10 years earlier. And she said, you know, oh, yeah, the media just wants me to cry. She said this in the book. The media's just waiting for me to cry. I was there at this news conference, you know, and the AP reporters are waiting, and finally the tears go, and then all the cameras start clicking, and it's just, and it makes me feel weak.
How do you feel that you're, you know?
You're right.
What does it make you feel?
Yeah. And she says, well, how do you think it makes me feel? Because if you feel sad, it means, but it's a stupid, what's that, a stupid question? And that's what she said.
Hey, thank God for public radio, right?
But, you know, in a way, I had to defend, just a slight bit, I had to defend journalism to say, like, yeah, but part of what makes these crimes so horrible is who it leaves behind. So I think there is some reason to get emotions out of people and stories, but anyway.
So we had this opportunity that I found kind of exciting because I didn't even know she was gay. Leslie Gore. And I know, you didn't either. I see. And, you know, for those of you younger people here, it's My Party and I'll Cry If I Want It, it's Judy Stern to Cry, You Don't Own Me. At 16, she was a teenage pop sensation in the 60s. And we had this opportunity that Eric scouted this up and got her manager, who was also part of her band, this was in 2007, to agree to an interview and telling him, you told me.
Yeah, that's
we're
a gay show. The LGBT, the
gay
radio show.
We're the gay people. Mm-hmm. We're going to do a gay show about the gay thing, and the gay, she's gay. We're talking about being gay, and it's going to be gay music, and she's a pop icon, but she's gay.
I tried not to lisp
she's
on the phone.
Lesbian. We don't even like that word. We don't even use that word. We say gay. All right. And
is that,
I'm telling
is that
you
go on the air?
Yeah, it is. I tell you what, I teach this, actually, in my work I do for NPR stations. I teach this thing about interviewing artists, because the older they are and the more famous they are, the more prickly they are. And this was a frightening moment where it's after her concert up at the Napa Valley Opera House. It's 2007, and she's had a bunch of wine, and she's been signing records for all these people who and all her fans, you know, because she's got fans worldwide, right? And I walk up to her, a little too aggressive, surprise, and I say, Oh, hi, Leslie. I'm Marilyn Pittman from the Gay Radio Show. And the minute she hears the word gay, she goes, "You got 10 minutes." In a kind of gay way. And I freak out because we've been promised 20, and we've got a 29-minute program, and we're going to fill the rest with music, right? I'm going to weave it and engineer it and do all the things I do. And so we needed that full 20. We weren't going to have any edits or anything. We needed the 20 minutes. And she goes, "Yeah, 10 minutes. And I'm like, "Rah." And so the whole time, so we sit down, we're sitting on a table just like this, and Eric's here and she's here, and we're going like this with the mic, right, and getting it all. And so you get an old prickly artist like this, somebody like the legendary like this, the best thing you do is you start talking about the past. You get her back to 16, and so I start talking about Quincy Jones, her mentor, the guy who showed her the way. And the minute you do that, she just went, "Boy, get her talking about that," and she just opened up about all that. We're going along. I don't know where it is in the interview that this cut happens, but I have decided to not bring it up, and I'm just trying to look into her eyes and be as soft and as kind and as quiet and as adoring and as peaceful and as spiritual and as kiss-assy as I can to please say this. And so here's the clip.
I don't know if it's you'll talk about this, but obviously we've done a little homework here, and I wanted to ask you about, because I miss her, Bella Abzug, who was such a pioneer and such a model for me back in the 70s, and I know she was a mentor to you. And can you talk about her influence on you? Because nobody talks about her anymore.
Yes, we do. There's been an institute that's just been started at Hunter. It's called Bally, the Bella Abzug Leadership Institute. Now, what could be better than having Bella's thoughts and Bella's expertise at speaking and knowing? She was so incredible when it came to strategy and working with people. This was an incredible woman. And I also have to say, in a funny way, Bella helped me kind of come out publicly because she encouraged me to be myself. She encouraged me to speak on behalf of women, and she encouraged me to feel comfortable in my skin. And for that, I thank her virtually every day.
Wow. Her voice certainly changed a lot over those 40 years since she was a teen star. Did she smoke a lot? Did we ask her about that?
I don't know, but she's passed on now, unfortunately, and I was really glad to have this opportunity. But it was one of those moments, any of you journalists here in the room will know, when you're like, "Yes!" You're like, "Yes!" And she gave us 17 minutes. And we used every second of it and filled the rest with all the songs and extra long slow credits.
Which we might have to do tonight.
Now, talk about your interview with Del and Phyllis. This is our last clip we're going to play here. And this is just one of Eric's most crowning achievements over this decade. Amazing.
I was just so thrilled, first of all, and humbled to that they invited me into their home, in their kitchen home, and we sat around their kitchen table and talked for like 2 hours, and they told me about their love story and their politics. They were the first couple to be married in 2004 at City Hall just before Valentine's Day, and they were also the ones who founded the first national lesbian political organization, the Daughters of Bilitis. But they didn't, they didn't plan to start that as a political organization. They just wanted a place where women could dance together without being harassed and arrested. They considered Valentine's Day their anniversary because they had moved in together on Castro Street on Valentine's Day in 1953. So I produced a two-part series. The second part was mostly about their politics, and the first one was more about their romance. So again, this is in 2006, 2 years after their first marriage, which was later ruled invalid. And then, they married again in 2008, just a few months before Del died, after they had been together for 55 years.
When I asked what life was like as a lesbian in 1950, Phyllis said she didn't know she was one until after she met Del.
I had no idea. Del knew she was a lesbian, and that's how I found out. But we didn't go into the whole homosexual thing very much in our conversations. But what did finally happen, Del and I and another woman we worked with were out one evening after work. We popped over to the press club and were sitting there chattering about whatever. And how the conversation got around to homosexuality, I have no idea. And one of us finally asked Del, how come you know so much about it?
And I said, because I am one. And then I thought, oh, my God, what
have I done now, huh?
Well, anyway, so then we chatted about what that was all about and so on, and we all went home. And for whatever reason, I don't know, I called everybody, all the women that I worked with, and told them.
That Del was a lesbian.
That Del was a lesbian. Because I thought it was the most exciting thing I'd heard in a long time. But I didn't want to do anything because I had this little habit of going after guys and getting them and then not winning them.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want that to happen with her. So I didn't get involved, but we went out a lot together and we went to the gay bar that was there and I met lesbians. And so she eventually made a pass at me before I left. Sort of a pass. We were sitting in my living room.
Was it a pass, Del?
It was a pass.
It was a half pass, and I completed the pass.
All right.
I completed the pass.
Oh, yeah.
You might have missed a little part. She says, oh, you completed the pass? No, I completed the pass.
Oh, yeah. So they're nice competing over who did it.
Still arguing after 50 years.
Have you had a good time? Thank you so much for being here. It's been a labor of love this whole month putting this together, and you have not let us down. You've really given us a great experience, right?
Yes, yeah. Thank you so much for being here. It's really great to have, we do produce radio, and we have it out there. We have no idea what the reactions are, so it's really gratifying to hear the reactions in the room, people laughing or whatever, laughing mostly.
Well, there's been some poignancy, and I hope that you've enjoyed it. I wrote this and put it together for us. That was kind of my contribution. And that wraps it up, our broadcast of Out of the Bay at our 10th anniversary party at the Oasis Cabaret and Nightclub here in San Francisco, in front of our live audience, our biggest fans and supporters. We'd like to also thank Heclina and Darcy Drollinger, also owner Jeff Benjamin and Jason Bebot for letting us use San Francisco's Oasis. We really appreciate it. A thank you to our bar staff and to Hillary and all the people who have helped us out here. Phyllis Pilot, Griffin Longstreth here at the club. Our food comes from Jim Angelo's Bacon Food Truck and Cafe, the famous LGBT sandwich. And Ellen Sinaiko's La Mediterranee at Noe and Market. That's La Mediterranee Noe, as she calls it, in the city. Serving Mediterranean food to the Castro for more than 30 years.
Now remember, you can hear the whole shows of some of these clips we've been playing for you on our website on the favorites page. You can hear Del and Phyllis describe their bar crawl on Castro Street that ended up with them being thrown out of the bathroom at Twin Peaks. Anyway, there's all kinds of juicy stuff in there, including a thing with Liberace, which is one of my favorites. We didn't get to play that tonight. Out on the Bay's 10th anniversary celebration is underwritten in part by Schiff Hardin, a general practice law firm representing clients across the United States and around the world with offices in 8 cities, including San Francisco. SchiffHardin.com. Thanks again to Brad Payton and Richard Merck, also from Portola Valley, for their event support. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Out in the Bay and like us on Facebook. And remember, you can always support Out in the Bay by donating at outinthebay.org. Thanks to Matt Martin, the general manager of KALW. He was feeling a little ill. He's back there somewhere. Wave, Matt, please. And to Eric Wayne, our engineer for today's recording, plus all the staff at KALW, including Bill Helgeson, Annette Bistrup, Joanne Marr, and David LaTulipe for their support over the years.
Eric Jansen and I produce and host this program. I'm Marilyn Pittman.
And I'm Eric Jansen. Thanks for joining us for our 10th anniversary party and show taping at the Oasis, April 29th, 2015. We'd also like to thank Gretchen McDougall for designing our postcards for the event. And thanks to our publicist, Lawrence Hellman.